the cards.
Put on that computer.
Thank you very much. Boy, well, after this introduction, Ivan, want to hear what I have to say. Okay, so I wish everyone a good kvitel b'zei yom adin. And if you're not well aware of the fact, today is the nete yom adin. And behavior, conduct, the reason we're up late is night learning because we're being judged. I'm convinced of the fact that the word gashmius comes from the word geshem, because without rain you have, you're not able to feed, there are no crops, you cannot feed the livestock, and chalila you perish. So water is critical. And speaking about judgment, we're familiar with the fact that the majority of Rishonim learn after Tzelcha, the perfect Tavos Asher Lovadot Hashem Lokecho B'Simcha B'Tuv Levav, that you do not serve God with joy. I'm translating very liberally, that the reason that we suffered all that which is predicted in Tzelcha is because we lack Simcha. And this Yom Tov is Chag Simchasenu, and we are now at the apex of Simcha. And therefore, if you have not yet achieved it, we have to focus on the serious problem of happiness before it totally lapses. So my talk is not going to be about Yom Tov per se, but about Simcha, which dovetails perfectly with what we're supposed to achieve. I just begin with an insight from the Kotzker Rebbe, which is such a telling and Jewish insight. It says in Shulchan Aruch, the Gemara, Mishenichas Oder Marvin B'Simcha, every seminary girl's favorite mitzvah. And if you're really original, you'll write on your door, Mishnefas our door, my door. No one ever thought of that before. That's really original. So what is the antithesis of Mishnefas other Marvin B'Simcha? Shira? Has to be a Shira here. Ilana? So tell these words to the Jewish audience. Michelle? Here's the answer. Isn't that a hard one, by the way? Excuse me? Right. A little more conviction. There you go. Says in Shulchan Aruch as well as Kepasim Halacha, Mishnichas Av Nema'atim. When Av comes, we decrease in joy. The fact that Kepasim Halacha is such a Jewish insight, I don't think this warrants writing on Yom Tov, because I think you'll get it without writing it. But if you picture, here's the bar, and we'll just gesticulate, here's Adar, we'll make a simcha, we'll make a smiley. So the question is, what is antithetical and the total 180 degrees to Marvin the simcha? The antithesis is of, you should have Mematim, here we'll make a frowny. So what would you imagine the point of departure, the center point, that would be? A baseline. That's the Kotzker name. Listen to the words. No, that's the wrong answer. Don't get so ahead because it's the wrong answer. When other comes, we increase in joy. When other comes, we decrease in joy. But the point of departure, the focal point is, simple. So that you have to remodulate a little more or less to the baseline is simple. You go up, you go down, but it always, we never stand simple. That's a good perspective. Can I go up the back? No. Most people, their expectations of happiness are, human nature conspires against us to make us unhappy and put us in permanent complaint mode. Be it our desires, our appetites for food, money, clothing, creature comforts, we always want more, or at least more than our neighbor. And regarding food, this of course is my great question to God, why is it that cheesecake makes you fat and celery doesn't? Now I cannot mimic the body voice, but the body never says, thank you very much, see me no more. It never says that. Your friend's parents come from overseas, they take you out to eat, and you try to put your end aside like a blimp. Where are you 10 minutes later? Just me? Where are you 10 minutes later? Where? Where are you 10 minutes later? Back at the French, of course. I work at home on a food processor, on a computer. And the drawback of working at home, it's like studying for finals. Every 10 minutes you go for nosh. I told my friends, sometimes they find I can't get out of the kitchen, you know. You always have to make the cake, you know, and then there's no end to this. And so that brings us to emotional wants, where jealousy is a major factor. Grass is always greener syndrome. And I can tell you from Shidduchim, where I'm rather involved, I have discovered, and this is based on my experience, I have discovered what is the most important thing to any young man who's dating. So aren't you glad you came tonight? What, time is up and I have to go? Okay, I'll tell you. What is the most important thing to any young man who's dating? Your Shemayim? That wasn't funny. Okay. One more time. Again, not conjecture. No, 100%. What is the most important thing I'm dating? I have discovered that the most important thing is exactly and precisely whatever it is this girl is missing. She had this, and this, missing that. That's what I need. Next one is that, missing this. This is what I need. Immature, yet true. Thus, that proverbial cup should be half full or half empty, when it's entirely full. And many people look at it almost entirely empty. Accordingly, what is the solution to the conspiracy of human nature, which conspires against us to make us unhappy and put us in permanent complaint mode? And then, I'm sorry, guys, I'm kind of sad. I don't know what to do about it. The answer are two words, often not used in America. I don't believe it's a big mystery to engage in America bashing, but it's particularly an American problem. And these two words are self-control. Happiness is a battle for self-control. Better put, happiness is a battle for autonomy. Or yet better put, happiness is a battle for liberation. Or, best put, happiness is a battle for internal liberation. For all liberation spoken about today is always external liberation. I mean, women's liberation, third world liberation, so-called Palestinian liberation. This will not make anyone happy. It needs to be liberated from within. Obvious proof, Natan Sharansky. Well, I hope you, I assume you're familiar with the most famous Jewish dissident. Here was a man incarcerated in Gulag concentration camps, totalitarian dictatorial despotic police state, solitary freeze box, and I suspect he'd more equilibrium there than many people in the West in the lap of luxury. Which, by the way, is why all these self-help courses can never work. No one wants to pay money to find out that I'm the problem. I want to pay money to find out that you're the problem, not that I'm the problem. You need to be liberated from within. There is no appetite which cannot be addictive. That's why the free person is the happy person. We become free when we engage in Torah. But who's the mighty man? Not someone who can beat someone else up, but one who can control himself. One who can't control herself. That's the mighty individual. And the way to do this is to curb the appetite. To establish points of contentment. Many people think, and I'm probably one of them, that if I earn more money, I'd be happy, / happier. So you have to establish a point of contentment. If I earn this amount, then I'll be happy. You earn even more, wonderful. You earn even more, your cup runneth over. But if you don't establish this point of contentment, no matter how much you earn, it will never be enough. I'll tell you how I learned this lesson. I was lecturing on Brookline in Boston. At the end, my books were arranged. There was a sale, and the sales were very brisk. And I was kicking myself that had I bought more books, I would have sold more. And my friend, I'll quote him by name, Mady Katz, said to me, "You're a fool." And he's right. I should have been high as a kite. Instead, I was kicking myself. So you have to establish a point of contentment. Self-control and freedom are the answers to the problem of appetite. So people think, when will I be happy? Well, let's go for a second to the opponent to this are the needs we think we have. If your parents told you to separate needs and wants, they did not lead you astray. I'm doing this all the time. I need to go out and play. Yingla, you want to go out and play. It's like a nigga in my house. You need to eat, you need to drink. You want to go out and play. It used to be enough. This is what do advertisers tell you? It's a science. You need. If you don't receive something which you feel you need, then how do you feel? This is a fill-in question. Then how do you feel? Bad? Good old vocab? Bad. Bad. Bad, mad. Not bad. I was going to say deprived, but we'll leave it at bad. MMI, clever, MMI. Okay. It's a science. You need toothpaste, which comes out of a spritzer, glows in the dark, sparkles, makes star shapes, and tastes like bubble gum. It's no good anymore out of a tube. You need. The motto of Mercedes is, we at Mercedes are here to provide you with all of your needs. That would be true if they'd say, we're here to provide you with all of your wants. Could you imagine? You need to eat, you need to drink, you need a Mercedes, you need... It used to be enough to have a Barbie doll. Now you need a Barbie Corvette. And Ken, and they got some Spucher, and more. And the real experts in this, let's see if I have this here, the real experts is the computer industry, who they have developed into a science how to make you miserable. They want you to know that before you move the computer out of the box, if you're from England, out of the box, it's already obsolete. But that's the hardware. The software's merciless. We subscribe to Computer Magazine, we means me, and I only did this to get a free mouse pad. And I had to stop the subscription because I could not tolerate some kids playing football they'll never comprehend. So I'm reading, quoting to you now from a advertisement, Mac User December, advertising a graphic program called SuperPaint, real fancy delancy program, and this is what they say about their product. Quote, beyond reality, you need tools as unlimited as your imagination. Take your imagination beyond reality with SuperPaint. Its speed is ferocious. Its versatility unprecedented. It's utterly precise, astonishingly nimble. Sounds like a rocket. Incredibly smooth. SuperPaint has rendered its competitors speechless. That's Mac User December. Comes January. You open up Mac World, you see there's a new product in the market called UltraPaint. What did Ultra people say about their super competitor? Quote, this may be super, but now it's yesterday's news. Evolution's never much fun, but newly extinct. Simply stated, UltraPaint is everything you wanted to do today and tomorrow. We've made UltraPaint easy, flexible, powerful, instantly expandable, and definitely underpriced. SuperPaint users take a giant step up the evolutionary ladder. Then comes February. They have ultra orthodox paint. Enough of $600. Don't be happy. You're miserable. It's a science. It's an advertising Los Angeles Times. I'm only changing one word. If you're not happy with your house, give us a call. Who wouldn't give them a call? Unless you paid and refurbished and refurnished, you could always be better. But there's no end to this. If you're happy with your spouse, give us a call. If you're happy with children, give us a call. I'd be on the phone all day long. They'll be happy to be miserable. But you're happy with your car? If you're happy with your car, Detroit is not happy with you. There's always a new and improved. New and improved. All right, we're off the topic already. Okay. So people think, when will they be happy when they achieve their goals? And here's a good point to make the distinction also between goals and expectations. Goals are a very important idea. You have to shoot for the stars. Expectations are not a good idea. If you always expect to be well, and you wake up with a headache, you're all bent out of shape. You always expect things to go well, and you have a flat tire to wait for an important meeting, because you never have enough flat tire to wait for an unimportant meeting, then you start cursing and cussing. So goals, does that sound confusing? Goals are important, expectations are a bad idea? Should I give an example? I always do this. I always walk around with a problem. You called my bluff. Yeah. Okay. We were nominated for a prize here in Israel, and out of 278 other candidates, to narrow down to someone else and myself. That is my goal, winning this prize, yet not my expectation, not to mention the fact the judge is the uncle of the other candidates. So goals are important, but expectations are not a wise idea. If you have a kid brother, then you know that every kid wants to be in the NFL and the L something, HL. But that's a recipe for disaster because you're not going to make it. But you have to shoot. You want to be the best, but not expect it. We'll come back to this. Okay, people think they'll be happy when they achieve their goals. And what are these goals?
It's a whole long laundry list. It could be noble, sublime, lofty. Usually it's not. The goals run like thin, bright, desirable, rich.
Now, what's my problem with this list of thin, bright, desirable, rich? My problem is rich. What's my problem with rich? Aside from the obvious. I'm bet I'm not. Now, I want to preface by telling you that we believe, we in Judaism, money is a wonderful thing if it's used properly. However, if someone wants to be rich in order to be happy, I do not believe it can work. What's my proof? The Forbes 400. The 400 richest men in America. I think everyone on this list, except for number one, is miserable. My heart was at number 393. To number 401, the poor guy, he's not on the list. If you want to be rich in order to be happy, you're announcing, I want to be miserable in my life. But honestly and truly, what's the problem with this list of thin, bright, desirable, rich? What's the problem? Why do I want to achieve these goals? To impress them. And who are them? Them are they. And who are they? They are them. I know not who they are, but Michael Vavron, whoever they are, I don't know who they are, but they don't know who they are. And if you're like them, whoever they are, I don't know who they are, then you haven't got a snowball's chance in tradition of being happy. This is it. And unless you're either here tonight or have attended the school's Hard Knocks, people don't go out of this. It's just pure adolescence. What's the screaming desire in adolescence? What do they think and what do they say? This is the antithesis of being a free person. In the world in which I live, the Yeshiva world of Jerusalem, in a standard operating procedure that comes to call money, you go on a teal with your family. So my kids say, we have to go on a teal. I love doing this. I go, why? Not that I'm looking. Everyone's doing it. So I tell them, I couldn't give a flying flip. If you give me compelling reasons, I'm attentive. So because everyone else did it, I graduated that. It doesn't mean they can't take and think to me. And otherwise, you're just a slave. What do they think and what do they say? To learn to march to be your own drummer, and not to march to be the society's drum. What's the screaming desire of an adolescent? Not only what do they think, I've always maintained, lucky the kid in high school wasn't the most popular, wasn't the cutest, wasn't the best athlete. For they learned in early childhood to develop the midot to both within, the proper characteristics within, and not just an image to force upon others. Then you have a chance at autonomy, then you have a good chance of being happy. Otherwise, what do they think of it? Gee, honey, the Goldbergs really had their act together. Of course, they're saying the same thing about you. You don't see them, they don't see you. And I don't mean to do it. Of course, they're happy people. You know, if you take a list of 20 people at random, what would you discover? The happy person is always someone far away. Right? Gee, they're so happy. If you take a list of 20 people at random, what would you discover? Four are nebs, six are depressed, two are this. And again, I don't belittle. Of course, they're happy. If I would ask the happiest people I know, if I would ask the Rosh Hashivas if they're happy, they'd say, they're so busy doing that which they're doing, they don't have time to think about, am I happy yet? Like the kid in the trip, Daddy, are we there yet? Are we there? Getting pulled out of the driveway. Am I happy? I went to the party. I went to the shenanigan. Am I happy yet? Am I happy yet? I don't know how to say this in a spiffy way. I don't have a good bite for it. But my idea is, the default should be happy. If something makes you depressed, you're depressed. But don't wait for something to make you happy. The baseline is, I'm happy. So, back to this, the goal, you know, what do they think and what do they say? There's a story in Helm. I'm sure you've all heard of Helm, right? All the perspicacious, judicious, provident, erudite, clairvoyant, sagacious individuals live in Helm.
all the foolish people, but this is, I know, might be a very insightful story. We all know that clothing identifies an individual. The fellow was told not to go to the bathhouse, and he was very concerned that without his clothing, he'd forget who he was.
A fellow with a dilemma. To avoid this problem, he tied a red string around his toe, so this way, even without his clothing, he'd remember who he was. He goes into the bathhouse, and somehow, as he was taking the shower, the string got dislodged off his foot and ended up on someone else's toe. He came out of the shower and he said, "I know who you are." Well, Mommy, this is precisely our problem. We're going to galvanize our own identity, looking at others without, instead of within who we are, and indeed who we should be. We'll always be mistaken. I'll just tell you the same story now differently. Or the same story differently. With the Baal Shem. Said the Baal Shem, the fellow was carrying a heavy pack, on his shoulder. He's climbing the mountain. He's climbing and scaling and climbing. Climbing and scaling. Trying to think about a ton of perspiring, schwitzing. At the end of the day, he looks up at the summit, the pinnacle. He seems to be no closer than when he started off. Baal Shem said, "Look over your shoulder. Look how far you've already traveled." And as he said, "Keep on going. Don't look at those without. Look within." And I mean to every one of you here. Think back, what was it, 4 weeks ago when you arrived? And you saw this crazy schedule with so many classes and so many hours and how we ever make it. And think how well you're adjusted now. Don't look at others without. Look within. So everyone here can write a diary, and I can read it and say, what a blessed life or what a cursed life. It's up to us to author that diary. It doesn't matter how much you have. It's how you react to it. We'll explain this. Now, I don't know you all that well. Some of you. Wise enough to be in my class. I know better. Yeah, last will last. Thank you. Others eat your heart out. They're rectified. But without knowing you, I will venture that we are better off than most people in the world. Nay, better off than most people. You are better off than 90% of the people in the history of this planet. Instead of being grateful, many of us walk around. 13 years ago, my family and I were in America for the summer, and I learned, if you drive in America and have the radio on, you learn a lot about sports. I was going to say you learn a lot about, I mean, I hear the stock report also, I don't know what it's talking about. I never registered. At least the sports I understand. At that time, 13 years ago, this year was an extremely impoverished and indigent and antiquated. But at that time, the highest paid baseball player was a gentleman by the name of Arl Hershelhiser, who got paid a mere $7.9 million for throwing a ball. The next highest paid baseball player was a fellow by the name of Dwight Gooden, who got paid a mere $6 million for throwing a ball. I mean, at today's scale of, you know, A-Rod, et cetera, it sounds like impoverished, but... So a reporter, I dare say, interviewed Mr. Gooden. He just called him Dwight. He said, "What do you think about the fact you're only owning $6 million when Hershiser is getting $7.9 million?" Which Dwight Gooden responded, now I cannot quote his total eloquence. He said, "Well, I get more than me, what?" The guy Nebuchadnezzar was miserable with $6 million. And he's going, "What about Nebuchadnezzar, I feel this for the Phillies, to get minimum 85,000. A follow you didn't. And I have the answer. He said, "Hey, bud, remember last year in the minor leagues, what was your great dream? To make a bundle or to make it to the majors? Do you know how many American kids would give their right arm to be in the major? Not in the majors without a right arm, but your belly aching. Should be high as a kite. Don't look at others without. Look at what you have, what you're blessed with. We're better off than so many people. I've been all over the world. And for a moment, I don't take for granted the money, the liberty, economic freedom, social economic freedom, and what we have to be grateful for. Because when do we truly appreciate that which we have? Yes. Correct. We don't have it when it's taken away. Half the show a zillion times over. You lose a spouse. And all of a sudden, these monumental, fundamental arguments are laughable. He sees the toothpaste from the middle, not from the bottom. Would you want to give him out of the squeeze the wall to be there? He should be here. We wrote the story of Chedva's Hilger Farm. Remarkable Tzedekis, the mother of three, ruler of Renaissance Shmirat HaLashon. This young mother of 27, her body was racked with a horrific disease, was admitted to hospital, and she, like most young mothers, was complaining about her babies. They kept her up at night and she was grumpy. And then the hospital, she said, son, I wouldn't get married, have my children, anything. They should be the ones keep me up at night. I would dance to them. I would sing to them, anything. They should be the ones. And not this nefarious disease. Appreciate what we have, and we have it. Otherwise, it's too late. And let me, we've come now to the most important component. Oh, Sarala. Till what time? Till 12? You're too nice. I know that, but what about the next? I just gave you a drasha. I don't do this to other people.
No, but I just
time. Isn't it true?
Yes.
Okay, so listen quickly. We're gonna skip a little bit. Not that you would know, but what is the most important component of achieving happiness? I won't even wait for an answer. We gotta speak quickly. The answer is gratitude. Hakarata tov. Let me introduce this with a story which I know to be true. I heard this from the protagonist herself. This one is a specialist in special education. According to New York State law, the homebound are entitled to an education. This one is a specialist in special education. Goes to school with one of the rare congenital defect, which has robbed her of her brain. The girl is 9 years old, lies in a Christmas school with toys she'll never appreciate, where she cannot tell the difference between heat and cold and light and dark. So the girl that raises so much thinking, the amazing miracle. And she goes to attempt to teach her motor control. Said that one day she was tending to a wealthy, affluent, religious neighbor in Brooklyn, tending to the girl. One day the father came home. She'd never met the father before. Wearing a real fancy glancy suit, goes over to the crib, scoops up the child. You know, children are soft, pliable, cuddly. This girl was stiff and rigid. He scooped her up, hugged and kissed her. So without any irony at all, what do you say about our Eitzer? What do you say about our treasure? After 14 miscarriages, listen, God, let's just mirror truly appreciative. Near a story like this, you go home and your kid brother's coloring on the wallpaper. You want to hug him and not break him. I think those of us privileged to go to a school like this, come from religious homes, have religious education, we have the obvious edge because we're taught from time for children to make a bracha. And what's a bracha all about? I was kind of hoping for a better answer to that. What? Correct. Appreciation. Provided, of course, that you mean it. I tell this to my kids all the time. Not just to say it, but to mean it. There was a boy in a yeshiva in Brooklyn who went over to the water fountain, made a bracha at warp speed on. Rabbi Victor Miller said to him, you can do it again, okay? It's okay, it's on me. You can say it again. I was flying to America, and on my flight with two of the Gedolim from the yeshiva where I learned, Rabbi Aaron Chadash, the Mashkiach of Yeshiva, Rabbi Aryeh Finkelhoven called it Tzadik of the Mir. And not for naught, it's called the Tzadik of the Mir. I mean, it's so righteous, pious and devout. Put your fingers over here, they'd be dripping to the Shechina. He walked straight out of Pirkei Avos, truly, truly, from the Nifty 50. And these men learned that I was on their flight. They asked if I was next to them. I'm a seasoned traveler. Fortunately, they are not. But my policy is whenever I travel, I prefer to sit next to someone who is not yet religious. So I told him I'll be juxtaposed with Pinkley, but not totally adjacent. Fair enough. So Rabbi Aaron Chodesh at the window, Rabbi Finkel, the great tzaddik, Israeli. I sat behind him, and next to me was a middle-aged Israeli couple. I introduced myself to my neighbor. He tells me he is Charedi Chiloni. Meaning not only is he not yet religious, he is zealously not yet religious. His wife is from the Dorish Mini Jerusalem. He's an 8th generation Jerusalemite, whose grandmother grew up in Bat Engar Meshem. She was Choseret B'Sheila. First time I ever heard that expression. That is intuitive being Choseret B'Tshuva. She's kicked the fold, and they're very proud of her. Needless to say, Edna worked it out for me. So I go into my spiel, gunished, like water for duck's back. 4 hours into the flight, it's a night flight, dawn is cracking. The bicycle jumps up. Here is the very first instance of Bechot HaShachar, jumps up, puts on the record, puts on the hat, goes into the wind-up, and by no means in a quiet voice he begins, Baruch, Ata. A couple next to me are freaking out. They tell me, he's one of yours. You get him to quiet down. I was not prepared to cooperate. They called up the steward, and the steward said, get him off the plane. I tried to explain this as highly impractical. Emphasis on the highly. They said, call the captain. After 3 or 4 minutes, felt like an eternity, at least Rabbi sits down. Couple resumes breathing. Say Rabbi Siegel gets up and goes to the bathroom. Comes back and once again puts on the record, puts on the hat. Goes back into the wind-up with all the histrionics and gesticulations.
Bubbles.
My neighbor says, now what's he doing? I said, sir, I don't know how to explain this to you, but there's a blessing I make when you come out of the bathroom. He said, give me a break. He said, no, all you have to do is go to the hospital. If someone's inlining, and their outside alveoli are rupture blockage, they're miserable, horrific, he has pain. Since it's ignited, we change, he turns to me and says, Tadema, you know what? Yeshua Zamash, you've got a point. The next 6 hours we took from religion all the way to America. He then came to hear me speak. We're both traveling to Los Angeles. He came to hear me speak. I always say it's for various singles, that's a blessing, to turn them around. That's what it means to make a bracha. That's what it means to appreciate. Every Friday night, I think I'm guessing the Kotel, we call them walnuts. And one Friday night, I brought him a girl off the wall, brought her for a meal, true story, stayed a little bit longer. After 5 weeks, I said to her, maybe you'd like to go to the Yerushalayim, good seminary, intriguing classes, good food. She said, no, I like it where I am. I said, nonetheless. So I personally called the taxi. Now, at the end of the story, he says from this married religious woman, has a couple of kids. She later confessed to me, her very first day in the Yerushalayim, she walked into the dining room, servant talking to the food before they ate it. We really spaced out. She said, now look, they're a problem. Still having my hat of appreciation, it's my fucking of gratitude. There's an Uncle Moshe song, and to tell you the truth, if I hear it one more time, my kids went a little bit too far with this one, but it goes like this. Baruch Hashem, for the sky is so blue, whatever you do, I'm a happy Jew, cha-cha-cha-cha-cha. So it's awfully corny, but it's awfully true, if you appreciate you're a happy person. One of the seminaries where I teach a course on Tefillah, my first class here is on Moda Ani, the prayer Jew says upon arising in the morning. I ask my students, honestly and truly, what are you thinking when you say Moda Ani? Moda Ani, listen. But if you can arise in the morning, I'm grateful I'm alive another day in front of the king. To jump up in the morning, this could be distracting to roommates, to quietly get up, I'm grateful I'm alive. And I urge you, don't trust me, try it. See if it doesn't make your day. So be appreciative. Okay, listen. Skip a little bit more. Nothing you would know. Okay, people tell me, why aren't they happy? Because life is hard, which is undeniable. Life is hard, and that's the way that it's configured. But no matter how hard life is configured, the one thing you can always govern is how you react to life's hardness. Obvious proof? Degree of pride, identity, dignity, possessions, even our hair. But the one thing I could not take away is how we reacted to life's hardness. And here I refer to Viktor Frankl's monumental book, Man's Search for Meaning. And even if you, like I, do not like to read, the book is this thick and this tall. And if that's too much, page 111 to 113. And he explains that even though his whole theory was developed in the bowels of the Holocaust, even though the Germans were free, it does not mean that they were liberated. You can always govern up here if you're a free person, if you're a liberated individual. Levinson Meyer, I wrote this story. It's what the Rebbe called, you Rebbe used to call this, I'm engaging in self-plagiarism. Levinson Meyer is an exceedingly pious woman. When she sent to one of these unspeakable camps, this is in Austria, she davened every day that it shouldn't be a boy. For if it would be a boy, she'd have the problem of arranging a bris. Now, I can assure you, most people in camps are not worried about a bris, but this and only this was on her mind. Women had such incredible faith. She took the slop that was fed to her, buried it into the ground, so that in fact it would be a boy, perhaps she could manufacture, cook for something out of it, and serve it at the Sudan Mitzvah on the day of the bris. God played a little trick. A baby boy was born. And then, miracle of miracles, on the eighth day, a transport arrived in the camp, and on the transport was the mail from her village in Hungary. She was ecstatically happy, said, must be about your mail messer, your knife for Mila, but he had not. She said, no, she said. Must be you made a mistake. But how could you make a mistake with those few meager possessions you're allowed to bring with you? Such an important reverend and honor he looked, and sure enough, he'd made an error, He brought the knife from Yehuda, performed the circumcision, and she held up a little baby Menashe that was undernourished. Hey, Mr. Menashe, don't cry. I deny you proper bris, but with God's help, I yet provide a proper bar mitzvah. And 13 years later in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, Williamsburg, and then there's more drinks and schnapps, the lakes and oceans and rivers, and schmaltz and gefilte fish that can fill vats and tubs, and kishkin and kugeln fill auditoriums and plazas, and everyone's eating and drinking and merry. And Menashe gets up to listen to our Mr. Drush's Pshetel sermon, and just then his elderly gentleman walks in from the back, the loaders are terrific, wrinkled, crinkled, disheveled clothing, but eyes that are chipped from maggots. He walks right up to the front of the room, the little Williamsburg stop gets to clink on a soda bottle, and goes, Menashe, oh, my, and goes, shh, trying to quiet down this intruder, oh, my, Menashe, oh, shh. One gentleman in the room were enterprising, the other passed him bottle of schnapps, but he could not be dissuasive. But Rabbi, sorry. Ladies and gentlemen, you think you're here to attend a bar mitzvah, you are mistaken. In fact, you're here to attend a bris. At this point, the hook is out. They wish to hear the end of the service. Everybody's song. Ladies and gentlemen, 13 years ago we were deep in hell, denied and beaten and tortured every day. There's your mother who reminded us who we are, and indeed who we should be. If you think what you're eating now is tasty, I want you to know that the little things you serve that used to the mitzvah was more geschmack and heavenly than paradise itself. If she can maintain that there, how much more so we can maintain it as we are? Life is hard, but that's the way that it's configured. The last thing you want to engage in is self-pity. Can you imagine Dwight Gooden every time he gets off the bat? Gee, it's so hard, they're trying to strike me out. Oh, for that to pay you $6 million. To which you can say, there are some people which have what appear to me an unjustifiably hard life. My reaction to this is what I learned, and the only thing I learned, in driver's education here in Israel. In Israel, if you have driving offenses, you must take a course in driver's education. Not that I would know, that I was in the wrong room when they were giving this class. And what I learned there was, I'm just translating from Hebrew, roughly, you can be dead right. What does that mean, dead right? The light turns green, and you have the right to go, and the car is approaching. Now, you may exercise your right, but if you do, you'll be dead right. Right here lies a man that was dead right. OBM, RIP. So even if you have the right to complain, you do not have to exercise that right. Two women lose their pocketbook. One woman says, okay, my keys, my credit card, my photo, my wallet, my passport, take me months to replace it. And the other woman says, okay, my keys, my credit card, my photo, my wallet, my passport. Thank God it wasn't me. And I'm no different than anyone. I don't want to lose my wallet. But if I would, I'd allow it to ruin 3 minutes and not 3 months. To interact the dike in the face of adversity. Life is hard, but that's the way it is configured. Okay, we're going to shift now just to one final point. Whenever you end, you always end a few times. It's better than it to end several times. I just want to make a distinction between fun and happiness. And here I'm indebted to an essay written by Dennis Prager. Now, I don't have a real specific definition, but fun is what you experience during the act, and happiness we experience after the act. In other words, it's fun to eat cheesecake, but after you get on the scale, you're not happy. You go to the ball game, go up and down all the ways, and scream, you have a lot of fun, but after you're caught in traffic, you're not happy. Fun is Coca-Cola, the tingle on the tongue, the roller coaster. When it's over, it's over. Happiness is a feeling which extends. My best example is Motzei Yom Kippur. And I do not refer to the fact that now you can eat. But you really worked on yourself through an Elul and a Rosh Hashanah, Sar Shemei Tshuva, you're able to get those sins off the shoulder and become a better person. Rehabilitated. Committed. Echoed straight into Chag Simchat Seinu. As I tell my kids every year, for you it's Sukkot, for me I'm still holding Yom Kippur. That's happiness. And the worst of all is compulsory fun. You know, by the way, the fun is such a foreign concept. That is why there's no word for fun in Hebrew. Because it's fundamentally not a Hebrew not a Jewish concept. Right, and what if you to correct me, thank you. Your cat is Arabic. There's no term for it because it's a fundamentally foreign term. And worst of all, these compulsory funds. And my greatest nightmare, I'd rather sit on a dentist chair and go to a party and go, ooh, Happy New Year. Because everyone says I'm supposed to have fun. And I want you to know that statistically, the most depressed day of the year, the highest rate of suicides, is New Year's Eve. And I'll tell you why. This is a shot. For all those who go out, they spend so much money, they expect them to have more fun. And those who don't go out, are miserable, no one asks them out. Those who are having so much fun, they can't take it. Because it's so much fun. But the reason that fun cannot provide happiness, and we're really ending, is because twofold. Firstly, because fun is a drug. And like all drugs, you have to always increase the dosage. In other words,
it used to be fun to go skiing. Now you must go skydiving. Now you must go bungee jumping. For those you're not familiar with, fly to New Zealand, tie rubber ropes around your feet, and jump off a bridge. And only 13% rise from this. A lot of fun. It used to be fun to watch a horror movie
on your neighbor's TV. You don't even know what that is. That's like a microwave with rabbit ears coming. Oh, they don't have that one. But you have to always increase the dose. I was never zocher to see a horror movie. But one of my study trips overseas is October, November. And I ride in the subway and in the underground. And every year I see the advertisements, or the advertisements. And every year, this year is the same thing as last year, but more. More blood. More guts, more organ parts, and last year's blood, guts, and organ parts. Nightmare on Elm Street. Nightmare on the highway. Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Texas Chainsaw Massacre in stereo. Louisiana Purchase Chainsaw Massacre. More, there's something physiologic. You have to always increase the dosage. The other reason that fun cannot provide happiness, which I'll teach us already, is because fun, by definition, means an absence of pain, and happiness can only be achieved through pain. Pain, effort, tircha, expenditure. You get up early in the morning to learn Torah. No one likes to get up early in the morning. It's not fun. It makes you happy. The decision to have children, is painless. Children make a mess, cost a lot, etc., etc. They're not fun. They make you so happy. But to share with you a personal example, for a living, I'm an author. Writing is not fun. At one time, my financial situation got very worse. I was competing against myself, but then I won. I wrote 4 books in 11 months. It wasn't fun. It meant a lot of deprivation. Not necessarily food, but certainly sleep. It wasn't fun, but made me content in doing that which I felt I had to do. My students tell me their happiest moment, the entire year of studying in seminary, is the night they volunteered for Yad Eliezer, shipping baskets of heavy food to poor people. And it wasn't fun. The coincidence was the Charlie horse, but it made them so happy. My analogy would give them exercise and massage. Massage will make you feel well, but exercise gives you feeling within that which is right and that which is proper. Or to quote my dentist, Dr. Kripke, quoting the coach from the Chicago Bears, no pain. You the same dentist? No pain, no gain. Therefore, we separate fun from happiness and liberate us in the following 3 areas. This is all part of my conclusion. First, in the realm of time. The amount of time that is squandered in the pursuit of fun. I'll give you a good example. It's very easy to say this for a female audience. Sorry, on a male audience that drives me out of town. The amount of time that is hemorrhaged on spectator sports. Because it's not just watching the game, listening on the radio, reading the paper. It's the pregame show and the postgame show. The pregame show and the postgame, discussing philosophizing the next day all over again. The pregame show and the postgame. In New York City, and many other cities in New York and America,
there is a sports radio network. That was known, I rented a car in LaGuardia Airport, put on the radio that was set to the sports radio network. It was the most animated discussion I have ever heard in my life. Jerry from the Bronx, Cecile from Jersey, Larry from Westchester, what he hit it, could he hit it, should he hit it, could he hit it, will he hit it, could he hit it, until I discovered this game took place in 1957. This is the basic term, how can you hit it, could he hit it, would he hit it, should he hit it, and how do I know that it can't be that important? You tell a person, you have 1 year left to live, I suspect they wouldn't spend so much time engaged in spectator sports.
They're making fun of sports. It could be computer games. We all know what our problems are. Separate fun from happiness is a lot more time at our disposal. Separate fun from happiness is a lot more money at our disposal. And this is a pragmatic as much as a Mr. argument. I know that this year's dress is more fun than last year's dress, or car, or home, or furnishings. It may be more fun, and that it makes one happier. And lastly, separate fun from happiness, it relieves us from addictions. To all jealousy of causes, all jealousy of causes of unhappiness. And therefore, to conclude, let me recommend that we avoid pursuing fun, engage in self-discipline, avoid comparing ourselves to others, avoid expectations, and most importantly, engage in gratitude, for gratitude is a matter of attitude. I heard a quote from Rav Tam Zichrono Livracha. I'm quite certain it's not his quote, but I heard it from him. Everyone is looking for the city of fun, and they don't realize it's in the state of mind. So now, we have to achieve, there's not much time left, l'chag simcha seinu, happiness, and we have enough pointers to get us started, be with the expectations, with the goals, with the gratitude. So that's our avodah. I wish you all a good Christmas. Thank you for coming. Thank you.